gentle. You know a man can crawl when he knows he's telling lies.
Hello, I'm your host, Kathy Irving. You're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by TechServe. We're here at Roberta's Pizza in sunny, sunny Brooklyn. Bushwick, that is. Just a quick note about our sponsor, TechServe. It's New York's leading premier authorized Apple reseller. TechServe has a solid reputation in technology, sales, and service. And as a company that believes in honest and forthright business, TechServe is a proud to sponsor Heritage Radio in the promotion of sustainable lifestyles. To support sustainability in New York City, TechServe is holding an e-waste recycling drive on Saturday, this Saturday, April 10th, from 10 to 4 p.m. For more information, check out techserve.com. That's our wonderful sponsor. So today I'm so excited, and I hope you are too, to have a really great, long-standing food advocate, food justice, food policy, tireless worker in that field, and an author as well. And she's just published a brand new book. It's a humongous book too, and I just finished it over the weekend. I'm so happy to have Anna LaPay on our show. Her new book is called Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And so thanks so much, Anna, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. So I love how you talk about, you know, you put it out there in the very beginning. Most people think of climate change when they think about, you know, the climate crisis. It's all about cars, carbon dioxide emissions. They really think about livestock production or even just, you know, corn production. Everything that you touch, you know, that goes to your, that you eat, really plays a huge role in climate change and emissions, and it's more and more prevalent because it's an everyday thing too. You don't buy a huge appliance every day. You don't buy a car every day.
That's exactly right. And that was a big motivation for me in writing this book, is to help people get it that what we eat has this direct connection with the climate crisis. And when I was doing the research for the book, I was particularly struck about how little media there is about the fact that the food system, and this includes everything from livestock production to the deforestation in climate change hotspots because of palm oil production, all of it combined, it's estimated that about a third of all global emissions can be traced back some way to our food system.
A third of a pie. That's amazing.
That's big, right?
Yeah.
And yet, as you mentioned, you know, we don't typically think about food and we think about climate change. So I hope that I am helpful in some way with this book and with the media that I'm doing around it to help be part of a whole group of us and many colleagues that are really trying to get this message out there.
And, you know, one of the reasons is because we've been eating for the beginning of time, right? We haven't had a, you know, huge global market for the beginning of the time, or we haven't had as many cars on the road for, so that's why it's like kind of an easy culprit. But you've really mapped out here how much the way we eat is totally different from the way we used to eat.
Right. And actually, many of the same drivers behind why we have the emissions that we have from the transport sector or from any of the other sectors are the same drivers with food, in the sense that just as we've industrialized so many other sectors, we've industrialized our food chain. So when we go into the supermarket, we don't really see necessarily the story behind our food. We don't see those smokestacks spewing the emissions. We don't see the pollution from factory farms. But we have, just in the same way in other sectors, we've become totally addicted to fossil fuels when it comes to our food, whether it's powering the tractors or the fossil fuel-based chemicals that we use, synthetic fertilizers, all down the line.
Right. And it's kind of, it's really cool how you talk about the future of things to come. There's a chapter called The Shape of Things to Come, and it's a little ominous because we can get so swept up in these amazing positive changes that we're seeing around here. Like, just, you know, here at Roberta's, there's like a rooftop garden over our heads. We go to a lot of great local food, I don't know, powwows. But there is so much stuff that's that you predict going on just with global trends, like eating trends, I found particularly fascinating.
Right. Although I should say what I really try to do in the book is I hope I achieve this delicate balancing act between the...
Nope, you're all doom and gloom. Just kidding.
Between the hope and the doom and gloom. Because I certainly am not a doom and gloom person myself. And I think that there are really two directions we're moving at once. And one of those directions is definitely heading us along a path that's pretty scary, but there's this other direction, and I think you've certainly seen it in your work, Kathy. I'm sure all around the country, all the people who are part of this national, now global movement to really reclaim our food, that's true, that's happening, and that's certainly one path we could move in that would certainly be cause for hope.
Right. Well, thank you, and you know, you're certainly a huge motivator in that field. I read Grub, I think, when it came out 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? And so forth. And it just grew from there. So your work has really, really inspired that. And talk about your mom a little bit, because she's really a forerunner.
Sure. Well, so the book title itself, Diet for a Hot Planet, is really paying tribute to my mother in the sense that it's playing off of the title of her first book. She wrote in 1971, now almost 40 years ago, called Diet for a Small Planet. And in that book, she was among the first to really try to dig into what are the root causes of hunger. She saw hunger all around her. If you remember the 70s, there was these, you know, massive epidemics of famine in Africa, and people were really wondering, you know, what was causing this. And there was this image of this scarcity of food causing these epidemics of hunger. And she dug into the research, and what she discovered as a young woman, she's 26, 1971, is that actually there was actually enough calories being produced, there's enough food being produced all around the world to feed us all, in fact, to make us all chubby. And so then that caused her to ask a deeper question, which is, why is there hunger in a world where there's plenty? Why is there hunger in a world where there is enough for us all to eat? And that got her exploring those root causes of hunger, and saw that it really has to do with not a lack of food, but a lack of democracy, that there's increasingly control over our food system among a smaller and smaller handful of companies that are making choices about where that abundance goes. Mm-hmm. And so this book is really part of a conversation, as I see it, that my mother started 40 years ago.
Absolutely. I'm hearing, Stuffed and Starved ringing in my head.
That's right. And so he's part of that conversation, and I hope this is part of it. And essentially what I say in this book is, along with the social and economic costs of our food system that my mother and Raj and others have pointed out, there's this other cost as well. And that's the cost we're paying with climate crisis.
Absolutely. And so it started with hunger. That's really what got her started, with like the hunger issues in Africa and other underserved parts of the world, and that led her to discovering our food system and how.
Sure, and hunger here at home too.
True, yeah.
And one of the things I try to do in this book is to help us see those global connections, and to help us see that, you know, the fact that we have almost 40 million Americans who are food insecure in this country. So that's, if you can, to imagine the scope of that, that's the entire population of Canada is about that size. So imagine the entire population of Canada living in the U.S. and being food insecure. So we have hunger here at home. We know there's extreme hunger all around the world, and the factors driving that behind it are really similar all around the world.
I really like how your book is extremely global, and your work is very global. I don't know how you go to so many places. It sounds like you were all around the world last year. But, you know, we can get trapped in this wonderful, like, bubble of, you know, food, green market awesomeness or something. But, you know, you really tapped into global trends. I just want to read a quick part, because I found this really interesting, just as a gourmand point of view, to see how you talk about cuisines and tastes have changed. So this is from the book. You're probably aware that more people across the planet, from Seoul to Sayulita, are eating our industrialized diet of highly processed, high-fat foods and chowing on meat and dairy from industrial-scale operations. Sure, there are still pockets of people who have never sunk their teeth into a Whopper, but throughout the developing world, the dietary revolution that rocked the United States over the past two generations is transforming eating habits, agricultural practices, and bodies across the globe. Change facilitated by the spread of curved yellow arches, a smiling pigtailed redhead, and a chipper chihuahua. Just a quick few facts. The trends in meat and dairy consumption alone are staggering. The United Nations predicts that that global consumption of meat will have more than doubled from 229 million tons in the early 2000s to 465 million tons by 2050. That's pretty staggering.
Yeah, I gotta say, this is one of the first radio interviews I've done since I've written the book, and it's so fun to hear somebody else read the book. So what I try to do in this chapter is talk about, if we don't do anything, where are we headed? You know, what's the trend line? And as you say, one of the things I point out is this global expansion of really what you could call the fast food diet that we've perfected mm-hmm. here, and you can see what it's done to our bodies and our health, and the fact that one in three kids now born in this country will develop diabetes at some point in their lifetime because of the junk that we eat. And I really try to drive home, though, this isn't happening because all of a sudden all these people around the world are craving this food and want it, and who are we to say they shouldn't have it? That the reason why this trend is happening is directly because of massive advertising and a massive push into these markets by our US-based fast food companies. And I think it's really important to stress that our tastes are being
force-fed.
That's right. And we're being advertised to, we're being marketed to. We can see what it's done to us, again, us in this country. And I think that it's important to see that, because as I certainly have seen around the world, that so many of the cultures that I've spent time in, the food cultures that I've experienced, you know, their natural indigenous cultures are so healthy and so delicious.
Sensible. Yeah.
Yes. And what we have here, you know, I feel like we've been the guinea pigs for this American fast food diet, and we certainly aren't faring so well.
And what were some of your favorite places that you got to visit?
Well, one of my favorite places was going to South Korea to spend time in Seoul and outside of Seoul on some farms with these really exciting radical farmer activists that are part of a global movement called La Via Campesina. You ever heard of it?
No.
Or you may have now that you've read my book.
Do they speak English? Could you go there and like... Wow.
Yeah. So, well, the group that was meeting were coming together from the Southeast Asia to really talk about what are their shared experiences as farmers, as small scale farmers, and how can they speak up for themselves. But what was also really exciting about being in Seoul is that I met with consumer groups in the city of Seoul that were connecting with local farmers. So a lot of the kinds of stuff that we are seeing pop up in cities across our country, but on a scale that I couldn't fathom. So I belong to a food co-op in Brooklyn that I think is pretty big. I think we have 13,000 members. Park Slope Food Co-op, 13,000 members. You know, I thought that's pretty impressive.
Isn't that the oldest food co-op?
It's among the oldest. It's among, yeah. Okay. But their co-ops there, I was talking to them about their co-ops, and they have a consumer farmer co-op that has 150,000 members, and another one I met with that has 50,000 members. So we're talking about a scale that we haven't seen, certainly in this country. And the idea is connecting people who live in South Korea's cities with their farmers and having that direct relationship with the farmers.
That's amazing. So it sounds like, do you think that this might be a viable a model to echo around here, or do you see it already?
I think we're already seeing it, and you can see it in things like here in New York City. We've got the green market, so we've got dozens and dozens of farmers markets.
Sounds a little like CSAs too.
And it's a lot like the CSA model, mm-hmm. which is community supported agriculture. Probably many of you listeners might have heard of this, might even be a member of a CSA. And the idea with a CSA is that you become essentially a shareholder in a farm. You invest in a farm at the beginning of the growing season, and you become partners with that farmer, in a sense, helping them get capital at the beginning of the year when they most need it, and then getting the bounty of the harvest all throughout the year. And you can become a CSA member on a farm that has produce. There's some that have meat and dairy as well, and honey and cut flowers and all kinds of things. So that's another model that I think is similar to
totally.
What I saw in South Korea.
And I, just on that point, I have to say, one of my favorite things about being a member of the CSA, not to mention the awesome produce that was cheap, was just getting to know this one family farm and the farmer, Fred Lee from Sang Lee Farms. And we got a little tour of the place, so I guess we're lucky in that sense. But just getting to know them through what they grow and when and how it came about, and knowing that all your food came from this one area, this one plot of land. It was a really cool feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. And the CSA farmers that I've met in the U.S., and they say all the time, they say, you know, I wouldn't be farming I wouldn't be farming if I couldn't do a CSA. I couldn't know my customers that they're farming because they want to know
they're not doing it for profit,
eating their
that's
food.
For sure.
And then they also say they wouldn't be a farmer without a CSA because they wouldn't be able to make a living without the CSA.
Yeah, it's financial suicide. Yeah, they're in it for the love.
That's right.
Cool. So we're just going to take a quick musical break. We'll be right back. This is Donna Summer's Hot, or yeah, what is it? Hot Stuff. Yeah, just because, you know, hot planet. Get it? On Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're brought to you by TechServe. Thanks to Roberta's Pizza and everyone here at Heritage, including Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener in the controlling booth. Today, and special thanks to today's
not the controlled,
guest.
But the controlling booth, and they're very controlling.
Yeah, they're just like drill masters here. No, so that's Anne LaPay. Aaron, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. And this is definitely, I got to say, this is the only time I've ever done a radio interview where pizza. Spread out in front of us, if you can picture this, is first of all, beautiful glass, beautiful window looking out onto a lovely sun-drenched patio and two huge salads and a beautiful, beautiful pizza. This
it's
is definitely
thing,
not your
right?
typical radio studio.
That's true. And I'm so excited that I just found out that I'm the first person on this station to have you as a guest.
Yes.
Wow, that's like a lifetime achievement. I'm next. I'm going for Michael Pollan. Just kidding. Actually, you just came out with this book. I was wondering this, but you just had a baby a few months ago.
8 months. Eight and a half months.
Oh, okay. I guess time flies.
Time does fly.
Yeah. So how was that juggling, you know, being a, you know, rock star researcher and running around the planet? And having this new life,
well,
as a mom.
It's actually been a lot. I don't know if the word is easier than I thought it would be. But well, first of all, I should say my daughter is really, really mellow. She inherited her father's genes, I think, of the patient, mellow, relaxed, calm genes. Got those from her dad, and so she's been really, really fun to be with and fun to be a mother to, and has been sleeping really well. So that's been a huge help.
Fantastic.
And she's also a great traveler. We've already taken her to many places so far. But I think what actually has surprised me the most about the whole experience of getting pregnant while I was still researching and writing the book, and the book was actually due the day she was due, so I was like working
ridiculous.
On edits, having a contraction. Yeah, it was a bit ridiculous. But I think what has actually been a surprise to me about it all, and I, you know, couldn't have predicted this, is that I think that having her enter my life when she did, I you know, and this is so cliche, but kids do give you such perspective about what really matters and ground you in what really matters. And I feel like having her in my life, I feel like has just re-grounded me into why I do this work, why I think it matters, what I'm trying to do with the book, and that sense of really wanting to be shoulder to shoulder with some of my biggest environmental heroes, who are all of us trying to turn our planet around from really heading over a major cliff here in terms of a tipping point of the climate crisis. And mm-hmm. so I feel like she's just been total inspiration to me to keep doing this work. And like I said, because she's a good sleeper, she's enabled me to do it while I've been well rested.
Do you think the food movement goals is, do you think it's a humanitarian movement, a humanitarian in goals? Like you're trying to, you know, it's about people more than policy, right?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily pit those against each other. I wouldn't say it's an either or. I certainly feel like the food movement, I think it's very, it's multifaceted. I would maybe even call it food movements plural. And I think that what, how I see the book entering into that conversation.
Yeah, we do need a better word for this at all.
How I see it entering into the conversation is I hope what I do with this book is get people, again, to go back to what we were saying at the beginning of the conversation, just to really understand the complexity of the connection between food and climate, but to go beyond that, to see that there are these really direct things we can do. There's the things we can do every single day with the choices we make about what we eat. And then there's what we can do as citizens, what we can do as community members to speak up for really shifting the direction our food is headed toward, away from a totally climate destructive direction toward a climate friendly one. So just in the same way that we're trying to fight for green jobs for new green energy like solar and wind and green transportation like more buses and high-speed rails, you know, I think it's time for us to speak up for green jobs when it comes to food, so to remind everybody that farming is the original green-collar job, and also to speak up for a new green infrastructure when it comes to food also. So really saying, look, we need to support our farmers. We need new infrastructure to bring local food into local markets. We really need investment in that, and we as citizens can speak up for it.
Absolutely. And aside from speaking up, what are some of those things that we can do every day? Or what do you think is
Well, luckily, the everyday things that you can do to support climate-friendly food, I mean, they're basically the things that you and I have been talking about for a long time, that folks like Michael Pollan, Marion Nestle have been saying, the very same food principles that are good for your health. Those that Marion Nestle would say, you know, eat more fruits and vegetables, eat less processed foods, those kinds of lessons about healthy eating, they are also the very same things we should be doing to help the planet. So what's good for our bodies is also good for the earth.
And so it starts with breakfast, basically.
That's right.
Throughout the day.
That's right. So in the book, I talk about the seven principles of climate-friendly diet. And again, they include things like probably for many listeners, these won't be totally surprising, but you might not have thought of these choices as relating to the climate before. But there are things like, again, eating less processed foods, eating more fruits and vegetables, getting organic food as much as possible, eating less meat and dairy. And if you're going to eat meat and dairy, definitely going for local and sustainably raised meat and dairy, trying to cut out packaging. Again, the kinds of things that when you talk about what it was like for you to not eat out for, was it 2 years?
2 years.
2 years. Yeah. The kinds of choices that you had to make because of that choice, those are also choices that you weren't making them because you all of a sudden, you probably weren't thinking about the climate. You were thinking about all these other issues. And yet they're all connected. And those are also choices that are going to help reduce your overall carbon footprint.
Yeah, I think just in general, like a greater food awareness will lead you on this path. And that's definitely what happened.
That's right. I mean, it's basically being curious about your food. I mean, I think that's where it starts is if you have curiosity, if you go into either a supermarket or even a farmer's market with a curiosity about where your food came from, what is the story behind your food? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to be able to know that, therefore, what is the good choice and what might not be such a good choice.
And to think, you know, we shop so much with a very keen eye when we shop for shoes or, you know, clothes or, you know, these food is an everyday thing that it should have weigh on your mind.
That's right.
A little bit more.
Yeah, I think it's Michael Pollan who has made that point where, you know, we spend all this time, for instance, trying to shop around for the best mechanic and doing all this research, and and yet we'll go to the supermarket and buy food from who knows who. We don't even know where it came from.
Totally. So do you, I like to ask this with everyone, but do you like to cook a lot? No,
I do. And actually, you know, through
with your crazy schedule and having a kid and everything.
Well, one of the things that I've discovered is, you know, just starting to cook for my daughter. I've been nursing her up until the last couple months and just started introducing solid foods. And
that's exciting.
It has been so exciting. And I got to say, she loves to eat. She's a great eater. And I realize actually how easy it is to make baby food. I kind of was a little bit intimidated by making my own baby food, and it seemed like, oh, it might take a lot of time, but it's really pretty much the easiest and quickest thing to do. To just, we have a tiny little blender,
food processor.
And, you know, I think about, okay, what do I think she'd like to try today? How about some corn and peas? And just throw it in, blend it up, and it's ready to go.
Hey, I would eat that.
And actually, half the time I'm eating out of her bowl too. So she, I think that that's been exciting for me to, just as a mom, to be able to demystify how to feed my own daughter. And I actually wrote the foreword to a book by a pediatrician called, his name is Dr. Alan Green, and the book is called Feeding Baby Green. And what I love in it is he really talks about how kids are you know, we humans are hardwired to be attracted to a whole range of different flavors and different foods. And that if you kind of approach feeding your kid not from the fear-based, oh my God, are they going to like their broccoli or not? But from the, oh, of course they're going to love broccoli. And they're also going to love sweet potatoes and corn and brown rice and all these other great things, that they really can pick up on that. And I know, at least, I know this isn't true for every kid, but in my daughter's case, I mean, everything we've tried with her so far except beets. She didn't like beets.
Okay. I think you have to be taught to think that all of these things are yucky by popular culture. You know, it's not cool. Oh my God, gross green asparagus or something. It's like playground mentality.
Right.
Like,
and then you think, again, think about the billions that the food industry spends to get kids to think certain foods are good and certain foods are kid foods and certain foods aren't good. I'm a huge fan of this organization called Corporate Accountability International, and they have just launched a new campaign called Retire Ronald, about arguing that it's really time for Ronald McDonald to retire.
Step down.
And to make this analogy between what the cigarette industry did with Joe the Camel and how Ronald McDonald has become this mascot for little kids to really hook them early on a diet that is giving them diabetes, making them sick, and really harming them for a lifetime.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so ironic, too. I mean, if you're eating at a place that is clearly marketing to kids with all these things and you're not, it's just, you know, let's all just bring it back down to simple, like the basics, you know,
right?
Kid food or not. I mean, we just, do you really need like such heavy, you know, who's that going to lure otherwise?
Right.
You know,
well, and I now that I have a kid myself, and many of my friends are starting to have kids, and just talking to some friends who are just traveling across the country, and they were saying when they were thinking about where they could stop with their kid, they realized that it was in the winter they were traveling, and really one of the few places where their kid could run around and blow off steam were the playgrounds
at the
of
McDonald's,
right?
Jeez.
And they, that was
interesting.
And they realized, well, then of course you're there, and then of course you're going to buy something, and then of course you're going to eat it. And just how that alone is one way in which families are drawn in and kids are drawn in to this food that's so bad for them.
I never thought of that. That's a really interesting point. And I know that you, traveling and trying to eat healthy is such a huge thing. And you, I'm so glad you participated in the Week of Eating In Challenge in February, back when my book came out. And we both traveled that week.
Right. I think I got to say, I did see your tweet pics on that. I think you did a slightly better job at it. I had every intention to be packing myself up with all this delicious food on the run. And then, of course, Ida, my daughter, threw a little wrench in that. But I did write about my experience of trying to eat well on the road. One of the points that I made is that I definitely feel like, as much as, of course, we live in a pretty toxic food environment, that it is getting a bit better. I mean, I was able to find that vegan sandwich at one of the delis at the airport in Washington, D.C., and I was able to find some homemade soup at a little store on my way to the subway in D.C. You know, there are these little pockets of places, and there's resources like Eat Well Guide and other resources that you can tap into to help you eat well on the road.
Right. And you also did a great job cooking, it sounds like.
Yes.
Throughout that
and I
week.
Yes, I've definitely perfected the what to bring into the hotel room to have some healthy snacks.
Nice. Next time I see Anna do something like cook that I made her I'm just gonna like, wow, that was really amazing to see you do that. And you know, it's a great learning experience, I think, continuing the food movement. I certainly learned a lot from Diet for a Hot Planet and will take a lot of those into, you know, to heart with everything I cook, I think.
Fabulous. Glad to hear it.
So was there anything else, any events that are going on this week?
Well, we're doing a bunch of events the whole month of April. It's sort of a blitz of Diet for a Hot Planet events.
Okay.
So at takeabite.cc is our website where they're all listed. We just had a launch. I was really excited. We had a launch last week with the Manhattan Borough President, Scott Stringer, who has been just a really inspiring leader nationally and here in the city to promote really smart food policy. So I was really honored that he was introduced me and participated in the launch. And we head out for our West Coast launch with the City of Santa Monica on Thursday, where the City of Santa Monica is launching a big food and sustainability platform, including they will be the first city to sign on to the Cool Foods platform, which essentially is a platform of policies and actions they're going to take to try to reduce their city's carbon footprint and the emissions that their city is connected to because of food. So that's our West Coast launch.
Cool Food. What?
Cool Foods. Cool Foods campaign.
That sounds and really neat.
Yeah, it's the Center for Food Safety is a partner with me with that campaign. It's a campaign that the Center for Food Safety has been working on now for a long time and working with restaurants, individuals, and cities. So we head out to the West Coast for that. And what is exciting about this tour is how many events we're actually doing with city governments.
Yeah.
I think that there's a sense of frustration we all feel about the stalemate at the international level when it comes to climate change policy and really binding emissions reductions policy. And I'm seeing and sensing, I think many of us are, that there's so many of us who just want to get to work. We just want to make some things happen. We just want to start seeing real change. And we're starting to see city governments really stepping up. And so it's been fun to see cities like Seattle, Portland, Santa Monica, New York, and more partnering with us for the tour.
Wow. Well, good luck on the road. Keep doing it. And hopefully I'll have to check out some more in New York City.
Yes, that'd be great.
Great. I wish we had more time. This is so unfortunate, but, you know, time's just about up for Let's Eat In. And check out takeabite.cc for more of Anna LaPays. Check out Diet for the Hot Planet. And we'll be back next week. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and Let's Eat In. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.